Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And they migrate from there to the air via the signal of this lovely station and our ever-growing number of affiliates, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, and now there's a podcast of Philosophy Talk available. You can listen to us anytime, anywhere.
So, Ken, today our topic is suicide, and I think we better start with by doing the philosopher's thing. Let's kind of say, what can we define suicide? Is suicide just killing yourself, or is it only some cases of killing yourself?
Well, it clearly can't be all cases of killing yourself. Suppose I'm playing a game, and I think I have blanks in the gun, and I put it to my head, and it turns out my wife or somebody switched it to real bullets, and I pull the trigger, and boom, I killed myself, but that's accidentally killing myself.
Accidentally killing yourself. Maybe it's accidental suicide, but at any rate, it's not a paradigm case of suicide. A paradigm case of suicide, I think, is one where a person has decided that their life is not worth living. It's too painful. They're depressed. Maybe they're heavily in debt. They don't see any other way out. That's a common phrase. But there are other cases. How about the soldier who throws himself on a grenade? Is that... It's not because he doesn't find life worth living. It's self-sacrifice. What do we call that, suicide?
Well, we typically don't. We think of it as just what you said, self-sacrifice, and we don't think of it as suicide. But on the other hand, a parallel case we do call suicide, think of the Middle Eastern suicide bomber who walks in. He wants to kill a bunch of soldiers or policemen or whatever, and the only way in is to, you know, get in there and sacrifice himself. But we call that a suicide bomber. We don't call it a self-sacrificing bomber.
Well, there's this distinction that's often made between the intended consequences of your act and the foreseen but unintended consequences. So you might say that when the soldier throws himself on the grenade, he intends to save his comrades from the effects of the grenade. He foresees that it's going to cost him his life, but if he could do it in a way that didn't require that, he would. So in that sense, it's not intended. I suppose the same is true with a suicide bomber. If they could walk in the restaurant and come out alive, they would. They just can't figure out how to do it.
So maybe we should call the suicide bomber the self-sacrificing bomber. But, you know, that makes it sound heroic, and calling it suicidal makes it sound kind of more morally problematic. But, you know, to extend your line of reasoning, I mean, just think about why, you know, your paradigm case of suicide. What are people typically aiming at? What's the intended outcome? That's not really to end their lives, is it? It's mostly to end the pain and the suffering, and they can't see any other way. If you could say, look, I can keep your life but end the pain and the suffering, I think most people would choose to keep the life and end the pain and the suffering. So that suggests that even the paradigm case is a little hard if you have to directly intend to end your life to commit.
And you wonder how many people are kind of confused and think that by committing suicide they're going to get rid of the pain in a sense that they're not going to, because they're not going to be around to not have the pain.
Well, there's that, too. You know what? To help us shed some light on this, our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, found some experts on the subject of suicide. She files this report.
Every culture knows suicide, from Cleopatra to Kurt Cobain. Most people don't talk about it, but maybe they should. Each year, there are almost twice as many suicides in the U.S. as there are homicides.
Traditionally, our Western culture views suicide with a great deal of stigma, shame, and denial.
Eve Meyer is executive director of San Francisco Suicide Prevention.
Suicide has been defined currently as something related with mental illness. In fact, suicide is related to pain, and the pain is culturally defined. The pain could be economic. It could be hunger. Someone has to kill themselves in order for the family to survive. The pain could be shame in a culture that is shame-based, and it's well understood that someone is required to kill themselves in order to rescue the honor of a family. The pain could be political. It could be required by the political realities of a situation. The pain could be physical. It could be in a society where the healthcare structure does not exist.
So, who's most likely to commit suicide?
In the United States, there are striking differences in how suicide occurs by gender and by age. For example, of the 30,000 people every year who die by suicide, three quarters are men, primarily older men, primarily European American men. And yet, for every death by suicide, there are also 20 people who make a suicide attempt but don't die.
Certain places attract suicides: the Empire State Building, the Eiffel Tower. I spoke with Ken Baldwin, a teacher in Northern California, about his 1985 suicide attempt off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Underneath the bridge.
Well, I woke up that morning and I pretty much made a point of knowing that I was going to die that day, that I was going to jump. I just wanted people to leave me alone. I wanted to be gone. That morning, I understood that this was going to be my last day on Earth. And so I told my wife goodbye, and I drove to San Francisco. And I looked at the bridge, and it looked nice, and I started getting a little nervous because I understood the enormity of killing myself. So then I walked approximately to the middle, and so I counted to 10, and I couldn't do it. And so I counted to 10 again, and then I vaulted over. The last thing I saw was my hands leaving the bridge, and I said, "This is wrong." As I was falling down, I started thinking about the people that I was going to miss, my daughter, my wife, my family, and that really upset me. I really felt like I did them a real disservice. And then I looked down, and the water was coming up at me, And that's the last thing I know. I woke up in the water, and I was swimming, and I was saying, "Oh, my God, please save me. Somebody, please save me." Ever since my hands left the bridge, I wanted to live. And then the next thing I know, the Coast Guard pulled me up and out of the water, and they were asking me, "Do you know who you are? Do you know what you did? Do you know who your wife is? Do you know your address?" And all that. I was in the water about 7 minutes, which is pretty incredible, actually, because, you know, hypothermia, shock, all of that stuff could have killed me. So I was lucky. You know, you roll the dice, and sometimes they come up good. I've lived for 20 years after I decided I wanted to die, and those 20 years have been pretty magnificent.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Polly Stryker.
Thanks, Polly, for that very intriguing piece. The music was from Kurt Cobain and Nirvana, if you didn't recognize it. I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And we're joined today by Michael Cholby. He's a professor of philosophy from California State Polytechnic University in Pomona. He's a leading expert on suicide. Michael, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here to discuss such a very cheery topic.
Yeah.
Well, Michael, we know you're the expert. You wrote the suicide entry in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. I don't know more of a more thorough treatment. Let me ask you about the motives of people that commit suicide. What do they really want? Typically, they're in the midst of a lot of pain, as we heard on Polly's piece. Do they want for their lives to go better? Do they want to be rid of the pain? The fellow said he just wanted to be left alone. Of course, well, if he's dead, he's not going to be left alone in the sense in which he wanted to be left alone. Do they really want not to exist?
I guess for your typical cases of suicide, not your sort of more melodramatic ones, such as the example of the soldier jumping on the grenade, the situation where a person foresees that their life is going to be very miserable from here on out, most people think that by dying they will bring an end to the suffering or anguish that they're currently facing. So it's an attempt to bring to an end a very unpleasant situation in one's life, very unpleasant state of affairs.
But I mean, our worry along this line is, is whether if there were an alternative, that is, if you could end the suffering and anguish without ending the life, wouldn't that always be preferable to anyone? And so that suicide, nobody really sets out intending as a kind of their primary intention to end their life. They want to end their suffering, right?
That sounds right. That is to say that death is not the purpose of suicide as such. That is, people who commit suicide don't want to die for the sake of dying. They want to die because it serves some other objective, usually, relief of physical or psychological suffering of some kind. So I suspect you're probably right that for many people, suicide is understood as, from their point of view, the last resort, right? The last way to relieve a situation that they have come to find intolerable.
People look at death in two quite different ways. Some people look at death as extinction. You don't exist anymore. But a lot of people expect some kind of life after death. Is there a big difference in the way people look at suicide depending on how they are thinking of what happens after your death?
Well, it's interesting because if one believes that there is life after death, then calling one's behavior suicide may in some ways be a misnomer. For instance, it was a very serious worry in the early days of Christianity that Christians would become very fervent about wanting to go to heaven, about wanting to be with God in heaven, and would kill themselves. But of course, on Christian doctrine, you're really not killing your mind or your consciousness or your soul. You're simply separating your soul from your body, and that would presumably be a good thing. But of course, if one doesn't believe that, then one has to confront the presumed reality that by killing oneself, one is really ending one's existence, that there will be no conscious existence that, say, in my case, would be mine, right? There would be no Michael Cholbe anymore.
Right, Michael. But that raises an interesting question. So I think I want to end my pain and suffering, right? Mm-hmm. And so I commit suicide. But, you know, in some ways, it's kind of, I hate to use this phrase, overkill, because the situation I bring about is a situation in which I'm not there anymore, right?
That's right.
So in some sense, how could suicide doesn't improve my situation, because, you know, improve your situation when you can compare yourself in situation one and then yourself in situation two. But in the suicide case, yourself isn't there in the situation two to compare yourself with the earlier situation.
That sounds right to me. It doesn't seem like suicide improves your well-being. It just ends your well-being. It brings to a conclusion, right, the narrative that is your existence. There are interesting sorts of, I guess you could call them almost delusions associated with some suicides. There's a category that's sometimes called dyadic suicide, where a person attempts to kill herself and is literally thinking about what people will say when her body is found, or, you know, what sort of grief they will feel and so on. And at a certain level, you can see that that's a, you know, pretty confused idea. I mean, after all, you won't be there to see how other people react.
So that raises the question, could anybody ever really have a good reason to commit suicide? Could it ever be a rational choice to commit suicide? Because you might think, well, look, you're kind of choosing this alternative over this other alternative, but the alternative you choose is, in some sense, nothing for you. I mean, it's not a state of your being. So you're not really rationally choosing for yourself anything. You might think that way. What do you think?
Well, I think it's possible for a person to rationally choose to commit suicide. I mean, the cases we've been talking about are sort of your paradigm instances where a person feels that their future looks very bleak. Of course, there's other kinds of cases you mentioned, you know, altruistic suicide, suicide undertaken to benefit other people, to save the lives of others. There's protest suicide designed to call attention to social injustice. Military suicide, the so-called kamikazes were an example of this. But there's, you know, all kinds of motives that people have. But I suppose in the typical case, it does seem questionable, right, as you point out, to think that suicide could be rational in this way, because it's not really a gain for you. It's more just the end of you, as you say.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is suicide. Our guest is Cal Poly Professor Michael Cholbe.
We've been talking about the motives for suicide and whether suicide is ever rational. In our next segment, we're going to move over and talk about the morality of suicide. What are your views on the matter? Let us know. 415-841-4134. I'll repeat, 415-841-4134.
Suicide, morality, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Suicide is Painless from the TV series MASH. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing suicide with Cal Poly's Michael Cholbe. Christianity regards suicide as a sin. Some philosophers, like David Hume, have held that suicide can express a free, autonomous, even morally acceptable choice. In some cultures, suicide has been seen as an honorable, dignified, even romantic way to die.
Is suicide always wrong, or is it sometimes morally permissible? Tell us what you think. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Michael, I want to pick up on something you said before we went to break, challenge you a little bit on this. Now, we're talking about typically teenagers who commit suicide because of they want their family to feel bad. They want people to say, oh, her life was so difficult, poor little thing, I feel so bad. Now, that's... I don't really want to support the rationality of that, but there is something interesting about the argument you use. You said, well, they won't be around to kind of enjoy how bad their family feels. But now take our president, George Bush, or any of the other presidents. These guys are always talking about history's verdict. Now, if they worry about history's verdict, aren't they really worrying about after they're dead, how people are going to react to seeing their written name? I mean, they're not going to be there to enjoy history's verdict, and yet we don't regard that as a kind of a foolish motive, or do we? What do you think of that?
Well, I suppose that, you know, in the case of you know, the teenager, I think teenagers are a very troubling class of suicides, largely
a very troubling class of people, in my opinion.
Well, that's true also.
Pain in the neck, most of them.
Pain in the neck. Well, and I think in the case of teenagers, there's a very serious question about the degree to which they really have a very firm sense of what their future will be like. I mean, most of us have various sorts of social troubles and anxieties during our teen years, and typically these troubles do eventually pass and we grow out of them. But I think that's an interesting sort of question you're asking, to be concerned with one's historical legacy or the verdict of history. I guess the question is, you know, is the president who's concerned for his historical legacy, is he really concerned that other people will say he left a good legacy, or that he will hear them saying that he left a good legacy? That seems an important difference, doesn't it, right? I mean, the teenager literally wants the experience, right, of the parents feeling tension and anger and distress.
Look, I don't want to try to talk anybody into suicide at all. I would try to talk anybody out of suicide. But I think there's a kind of point in John's remarks that you're missing a little bit. I mean, you might think of suicide, I phrase the question for you, as suicide between existence, a choice between existence and non-existence. And how could you prefer non-existence over existence? Because it's not a state for you. But that was a trick, right? Because what you're really choosing maybe is it's a choice between lives. Would I rather have, every life is going to end, every life has a period. Would I rather have a life that went like this, you know, that includes some episodes of continuing suffering, say? Or would I rather have a life that ended now with the period here? So it's just a question of where to place the period. And surely one could rationally prefer a life that ended now. A longer life isn't always a better life, right? A life that ends now might be preferable to all other possible lives available to me. Well, and I could rationally choose that.
It's a shift of perspective. Suppose we're singing, right? Suppose we're the Beatles and we're singing Hey Jude. And we've gone on for 4 minutes, a pretty long song already, and Ringo's drumming is getting pretty bad. So we say, let's call it end to this song. It'll be better if we quit now than if we keep going. That's a rational choice. Let's have a good 4-minute Hey Jude rather than a 5-minute Hey Jude that, although it is longer, gets lousy. So that would be a rational choice. You can think of your life like that. But if you kind of combine the things, so you think by making your life shorter, you're going to make it better in the sense that you're going to enjoy not having all the pain anymore. That's pretty confused. And like the guy that jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, I think a lot of people are pretty confused when they commit suicide.
What do you think, Michael?
Well, I would agree with that. I think that there is a confusion that does often enter into the thinking of suicidal people, that they're in some sense going to continue to live, right, without whatever pain or suffering motivated them to do this in the first place. And I think the way that both of you have been expressing the point sounds exactly right, that you're choosing between alternative ways to conclude your life. Is it going to continue past a certain point, or can I rationally choose that it come to an end sooner rather than later? And I would agree that one can rationally choose for one's life to be shorter rather than longer, and that the longer life is obviously not necessarily the better life. So I think I would agree with that approach. I was just pointing out that, you know, they're in people's thinking about suicide, very often that their thinking is colored, right, by the expectation that in some way they will continue to experience their life, and
right.
that they're often motivated by the idea that something good will happen by them killing themselves, that they themselves will be there to experience. They'll get to see other people wailing and moaning, or take their vengeance out, or you know, tell that lover who jilted them just where he or she can go.
Area code 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Give us a call and tell us what you think. And Chip in Menlo Park's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Chip.
Well, thank you. Hi.
Hi. What's your comment or question?
Well, actually, you kind of just got to it. It's this whole question about the cessation of suffering. That when you talk about suicide as a decision, a conscious decision to cease suffering, then certainly it's a rational decision. It's not. It may not be a decision that we, you know, that people may think, well, I wish you'd thought of other alternatives. But nonetheless, it is a rational choice.
It can be, Chip.
It can be. Yes, exactly. Yes. Right. I mean, it can be a perfectly rational choice to make that choice to cease your suffering by stopping.
Right. I think we agree. I mean, but what we were trying to do, Chip, is see how it could be rational. I mean, if it's a choice between existence and non-existence where you're not around, you're not choosing a state for yourself. But if it's a choice between two different lives, using John's Hey Jude metaphor, then you can begin to see how it can be rational.
Yeah, but right. Sounds like you agree with that, Chip. Yeah.
Yeah, and you hadn't said it up until that moment.
Yeah,
and then I was waiting on hold, and now you have.
Great, great minds kind of work alike. Now, you know, in a way, though, the question is we often feel that a suicide is irrational, but the question is, why is it irrational? Take our fellow back in Polly's piece that jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. At that moment, had you discussed whether he should commit suicide, you can imagine that the discussion would have been very rational. He just had looked at life a certain way. He was deliberating. It wasn't a sudden urge. It wasn't an impulse. And yet you'd think that's irrational. Why? Well, because if he waits around, some other emotions, some other cares will move in, and things will be different. It may be rational in terms of how he feels now, but doesn't rationality put some obligation on us to hold off and maybe take more things into account than are occurring to us now? Once he jumped, he got some new emotions. First of all, he remembered how much he enjoyed his family. And then on the way down, he had time to even shift perspective and think how much they were going to miss him and what pain it would cause. So there's a kind of rationality in the sense of being rational and deliberative is one thing, but in the sense of taking into account everything you should be taking into account, that's what's often missing.
What do you think, Michael?
Well, that's exactly right. It's interesting that one of the tips or pointers that's often given to those who work at suicide crisis hotlines is simply to keep the suicidal person on the line. Many people who call these hotlines have already done something that is risky. They've already harmed themselves in some way. They've slashed their wrists or taken a large number of over-the-counter painkillers or something like that. And these counselors are given the advice to keep people on the line, largely because, in most cases, the suicidal impulse, whatever it is that's moving the person to engage in this risky behavior in the first place, will subside. Right, it will subside of its own accord. Life will change. Your neurochemistry will change. You'll change your mind in mid-jump, as the gentleman did in your introductory piece. And a good many people, you know, call these suicide hotlines basically changing their mind. Right, they thought they really wanted to die, but once they actually confront the possibility, once they actually have done the deed, so to speak, it doesn't seem so attractive anymore.
Now,
so
on that,
I think that's.
On that score, I want to say that if anybody's listening and wants to talk to a trained professional about suicide, call 1-800-784-2433.
We've got some callers on the line here. Tom on 880. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tom.
Thank you. I want to discuss the idea of rational choice there in terms of taking into account many different factors. The person, I don't think basically that... almost all suicides are rational choices. I think they're irrational. I'm reminded of a paper that a psychiatrist named Ferenczi wrote, where he found that children who were unwanted, perhaps from birth, had a great tendency to have a collapsed horizon, morbid thoughts. And so, in a sense, their consciousness had been conditioned, in a sense, to have a much narrowed and gloomier horizon, and in that sense, their choice isn't really much of a choice as compared to someone who was raised with a lot of optimism or conditions that created optimism.
Tom, I think, I mean, you have a point. It's surely a lot of suicides are irrational. And you think, Tom thinks, Michael, that they're mostly irrational, it sounds like. But here's a little, that's kind of connected to the question of whether it's ever morally permissible. Here's a little argument for you. Tell me what you think of this argument. So, look, it would be wrong of me, it would be wrong of me to kill another person, say John, who is in utter despair, right, of ever ending his suffering, and say, oh, I'm going to relieve him, I'm going to kill him. That would be wrong, right? That's because his life is intrinsically valuable, and I have no right to disrespect the value of his life. My life is just as valuable as him. His, if I have no right to kill him, you know, because of the value of his life when he's in despair, I have no right to kill myself because of the value of my life, even though I'm in despair. What do you think of that argument?
Well, I think it's a more powerful argument than people give it credit for. And it was recognized very long ago. One of the fathers of the Christian church, Augustine, pointed out that in the Ten Commandments it says, thou shalt not kill, not thou shalt not kill other people. Right? And he took that to mean that we're not supposed to kill ourselves either. And I think that the argument you've just outlined is in fact very troubling. I sometimes call that rough line of reasoning, call it the asymmetry problem, right? If I'm not permitted to take another person's life in most circumstances, I mean, we might admit a few exceptions, but in most circumstances, I'm not permitted to take another person's life. Why am I so special, right? I mean, it sounds almost egotistical to say, well, I myself am special, right? I'm permitted to take my own life, but I'm not permitted to take other people's. And we're all supposed to stand in that same relationship to ourselves, right? That we ourselves, I don't know, we know more about our own welfare. We're better judges of our futures. I don't know, we care more about our own welfare. I think there's a few moves one could make there, but it's actually a very powerful and interesting argument, right? If it's wrong for me to kill another person in roughly the same circumstances as me, right? Why is it morally permissible, or why could it be morally permissible to take my own life?
Now, right? now we've got an email here from Jeff Chandler who mentions Albert Camus, I guess, a diametrically opposed point of view. According to Jeff, Albert Camus wrote that the only serious question for a modern person was why he should not commit suicide. Jeff says, I came to believe in college many years ago that I was therefore not a modern person.
Camus in The Myth of Sisyphus says suicide would be, I can't remember exactly, a cheap way out. I mean, that courage is living on in face of the absurdity. Do I have that right, Michael? Roughly?
I think that's about right. Camus is not a figure that I'm that knowledgeable about, but he does seem to think that it's an act of defiance in the face of the sort of inherent meaninglessness of human existence.
But
you're
question,
seizing the meaning, I guess.
Yeah, the question is, I mean, in the face of meaninglessness, I don't know. It just seems like Camus was full of it to me.
Yeah, well.
I mean, look, if you're not in great pain, if you're not actually suffering yourself, there's so many things you can do. You can scratch yourself. That feels good. You can eat something.
Oh, you're rejecting the absurdity of life.
Well, you can go find a kid that wants a little attention or a dog or a cat.
Right.
It's not that hard. You don't need to be defiant. Just need to kind of break out of your self-absorption a little bit.
Okay. Steve in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Steve.
Hi there. Great show. A couple quick points and then a quick question. First of all, I think, and I'm not an expert, but I think also in the Jewish religion that suicide is outlawed. In fact, I think people that commit that are not allowed to be buried in the same cemetery. Point two is I think on the lyrics from the MASH song are from the film, because on the TV show they did not use that because they thought it would offend or scare people.
I think you're right.
And then also my third point is that I have a long life live because I have a lot of people I got to get back at. So, but my question is this: is I had a good friend of mine who was my parents' mailman who killed himself, and it's very sad. But I think the best word to go along and to counsel people is that it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Well,
several good points there. Yeah. Thanks for the call.
Charles in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charles.
Hi. I was just thinking that, you know, discussing this from a very Christian point of view,
Well, change our perspective.
He thinks differently. You know, like Roman generals who were defeated fell on their swords in Japan, which you referred to. You know, people committed seppuku. It's a matter of honor.
Right.
But really what I want to say is not the ability to take your life, the ultimate freedom, which is pretty well denied in our society, but is, you know, if you're free to do everything, you can vote, you can mouth off in front of the White House, why can you not kill yourself?
Charles, that's an excellent question. I'm going to put it to Michael, who liked my argument, because that's the kind of counter against that argument. I have a kind of dominion over myself. I own myself or something. I autonomously govern myself. And if I freely choose to end this life, well, that's a free, autonomous choice. And who is anybody else to say, no, don't do that?
Well, I do think that's a powerful sort of libertarian stance to take on. And I think politically, I have some sympathies with that. But even if you grant that people have the right to do this, perhaps that we would not want the state to, you know, interfere with suicide, criminalize it. I mean, it was criminal, of course, in you know, many societies and cultures. Still is in most states illegal to take your own life.
What do they do if you succeed? Lock you up?
Well, of course, in the past, they would deny you Christian burial or invalidate your will so that your descendants would not inherit your wealth or something like that. But, you know, even if you grant the political point, right, that maybe we don't want to have the state or the government intervening with these choices, there's still the question of whether it's a wise choice, right, of whether it's a smart ethical choice, right, from the standpoint of one's, you know, welfare or well-being as to whether or not, you know, you ought to do this. So I appreciate the caller's sentiment, you know, that perhaps we do want to leave this, perhaps from a political standpoint, up to people's judgment. The question is, how much should we trust their judgment, right? How much should we think that people have an accurate and well-thought-out picture of the merits of taking their own life on some particular occasion? I think we should probably be second-guessing people's intentions in most cases.
Charles, thanks for the call. Interesting point. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing suicide with Cal Poly's Michael Cholbi.
We've been talking about the morality of suicide, whether suicide is always wrong or sometimes permissible, and if so, under what circumstances. Coming up next, what do we owe to those who have chosen suicide? Should we try to stop them or dissuade them? Or is it ever permissible to assist them?
Suicide, to assist or dissuade. Plus more of your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Elton John and Think I'm Gonna Kill Myself. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing suicide with Cal Poly's Michael Cholbi.
What do we owe people who are suicidal? What's your opinion? 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us comments@philosophytalk.org.
So you've got a friend, Michael, who's bent on suicide. He's convinced you. He's got good reasons. It's a morally acceptable situation. What do? Do you try and talk him out of it? Are you obligated to assist him? How do you think about that? What do you owe him?
Well, I think at a minimum, I do think we owe the suicidal some attempt to ensure for themselves, right, that they're thinking clear-headedly about what they're doing. Enough suicides occur where people are depressed, where they're undergoing, say, a great amount of stress or grief. These conditions, as we've mentioned before, often pass, and that a person might regret, right, committing suicide under those conditions.
If you can't talk them out of it, can you stop them? But can you coerce them out of it?
You know, I don't know that I have a settled position on this. I do think that there are certain populations that I think we should be willing to coerce, for example, children and teenagers. But I think, you know, grown adults, we should be reluctant to coerce them. But I also think that there are ways of intervening in their affairs, trying to convince them that this is not a wise decision. Taking away the means of suicide, whatever it might be, weapons or drugs, whatever it might be, I don't think those are unjust interferences with their liberty.
What about assisting them? Can you ever? They've convinced you it's rational. They've considered all the alternatives as in one of these morally permissible situations. And they need your help. You give it to them?
Well, I think you're permitted to help somebody whose suicide is itself morally permissible, but I don't think that you're required to do so.
So, the kind of paradigm case that at least I think about is, and maybe it is a paradigm case judging from the statistics that was a father in his, 50s who's facing bankruptcy and his business has gone down the tubes and his kids are being obnoxious. And so he kills himself. And then when you see the effects on the family, you think, gosh, if he could have seen how this was going to destroy people's lives or at least affect them for a long, long time, he wouldn't have done that. But there's another kind of case, and our emailers are kind of encouraging us to move over to this kind of case. Marilyn puts it, what about the case of an incurable disease and deciding to end your own life before it gets too painful? And then Max and Michael say, if you can put a dog or horse out of its misery, you cannot offer to help. Can you not offer to help give a human the same consideration, assuming, of course, they ask you to? We are, of course, discussing here physician-assisted end-of-life choice. So what about these cases in which it's towards the end of a life and if they just hang on, things are going to get better? They're not going to get better. How about suicide in those cases, guys?
What do you think, Michael?
Well, I think in the case of a person with an incurable and perhaps very painful illness, I mean, there are questions that could be posed there. You know, how long has the person lived? Have they had a chance to live a decent life? You know, I think when you're talking about, an 80 or 90-year-old cancer patient, I think we're inclined to say that whatever value could be had out of that person's life has already been realized, and that suicide in those circumstances would be permissible precisely because there's nothing to be gained, right, by continued living. I mean, I think those are the cases that seem most clear-cut to me, though you'll note that even in those states, for example, Oregon, that have, physician-assisted suicide laws, they kind of double-check, right? They require, more than one diagnosis of your condition. They require you to, sign a document saying you want to die and then, certify that document a certain amount of time later to really ensure that this is what you genuinely want. Because, of course, I think we would all be reluctant to permit or endorse suicide on a whim.
Yeah,
somebody has a bad afternoon.
Certainly you're right, Michael. We've got lots of callers here, and I'll try to get as many as I can in our brief time left. Jim in Sunnyvale, welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jim.
Hi, I just wanted to expand a little bit on the rationality argument. If you are rational, you start thinking about suicide, you've got to think about the effects on others. For example, a guy tried to gas himself in his garage and wound up killing his whole family outside. Or you jump off a building and you hit a bunch of Sunday schoolers touring the building. So the question is, how do you do it without making a great big mess and hurting others physically in the process?
Yeah, well, and emotionally, too.
Yeah, and then you leave the financial problems. You have to take care of that in advance. And like this guy that jumped off the bridge, he's walking around now. But what if he was quadriplegic and had to take a lifelong care for the rest of his life?
Many good considerations, and I think maybe by definition, suicides tend to be a little self-absorbed at the time they do this act, it's easy to not think through its effect on others.
Yeah, that's true. But there's also the question. It's my life, and I'm not merely a tool for others. And if my life is miserable and I want to end it, what good am I to others hanging around miserable? So it's a complicated thing. Ron on the bridge. I hope you're not about to jump. Ron is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ron.
Thank you. Question. Socrates in the Apology, as he ends up his statement, he says, "Now the time to part has come. I go to live, you go to die." I'm sorry, I go to die, you go to live. Which of us goes to the better place is known only to the God. The emphasis has been on living. My question is, when you place the emphasis on the considerations for it...
Oh, Ron, you're breaking up, but can you hear us?
That some have.
Can you say that last part again? You broke up.
Oh, I'm sorry. The last part being...
When you place the emphasis, you said...
Yes, the emphasis is frequently on life here in this discussion. The question I have is the sacrificial bomber, as we'll call him in this context, has an emphasis on the afterlife. The question is, if we don't know what the afterlife is, if there's such a thing, then why so much consideration of the future life that one might anticipate if he continues to live?
Well, I think that's a very good question for those that consider that it's a certainty or at least a live possibility that there is an afterlife. And as Michael reminded us earlier, in Christianity, the afterlife was so attractive that may be one of the motives for really criminalizing within the church the idea of suicide. Otherwise, you have people really convinced they might be doing it willy-nilly. But it seems to me philosophically, it's a whole different problem depending on what you think happens after you end your earthly existence.
So, Michael, I'll give you one last comment to make on that point or any point, then we'll have to say goodbye.
Well, on that point, I certainly think that John is right. I mean, how one understands what's going to happen to you will certainly influence people's thinking. But of course, you know, I think that there's sort of an argument from uncertainty to be made there. I mean, if you have any doubt whatsoever as to whether or not there's an afterlife, well, you shouldn't have any doubt as to whether or not there is a life you're living now, right? And that, you know, that seems to me to make it an easier decision to take into account what you definitely know for sure, which is that you're alive here and now. And, you know, one can bring that life to an end sooner or later. And I think that's basically, you know, the core issue, both for questions about the moral permissibility and about the rationality of suicide.
So Michael, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really interesting conversation. Our guest has been Michael Cholbi, professor of philosophy at California State Polytechnic University in Pomona, a leading expert on suicide, author of a very fine article on suicide in the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy.
And you can get the Stanford Encyclopedia online. Just search for it www.plato.edu. I think that'll get you to it. And he's got lots of citations in that article. You want to read some of the classic philosophers about suicide. We want to also thank all the callers we didn't get a chance to talk to. By the way, if this show or life in general has gotten you thinking about suicide and you want to talk to a trained professional, there is a number, 1-800-784-2433. So we encourage you to do so.
Yeah, we definitely do. So, John, what did we learn today? What's your thinking?
Well, it was a fascinating discussion about a fascinating, if somewhat depressing, topic. There's a couple things I wish we could have spent more time on. From the statistics, there's a lot more suicides than murders in the U.S., but we don't worry about it near as much.
That's true. Have you ever seen, except for a famous person committing suicide, have you ever seen Nightly News Bulletin, suicide in Petaluma? You never see that.
Well, only the murder suicides, right? If you want to get your suicide on the news, you better take the rest of your family out with you. Another thing we didn't get to that is very interesting, it was brought up by one caller, is cultures in which suicide is a very respectable thing to do, and matter of fact, a required thing to do in certain circumstances. I'd like to explore that. I'm kind of ambivalent about it. I sort of admire the Roman or the Japanese who in disgrace kills himself, but I don't much admire the people that kill their daughters because they've been disgraced.
Well, that's certainly true. But I think there's that Roman thing, that Japanese thing, goes back to you have to think of the choice of suicide in many contexts as a choice between lives. Right? A life that goes on in these circumstances is filled with dishonor, right? These folks might think. But a life that ends here in this way is more honorable. And would I rather have a more honorable life or a less honorable life? So you can think of it as a choice between competing lives.
It seems to me that there are people that, if they were rational, would commit suicide, mass murders, if they really knew what they had done, would do that.
But this conversation continues on our blog, Philosophy Talk, the blog, where our motto is cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog, www.theblog.philosophytalk.org.
And you can download podcasts of our programs from our website as well.
John, hear that drumming? You know what that means?
It means we're going to listen to a rerun of Dragnet.
No, John, it's conundrum time, and we have a caller on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Francisco.
Hi, how are you doing?
Just fine. Where are you calling from, Francisco?
Berkeley.
Berkeley, oh, my favorite city.
Yeah, and what do you do over there in Berkeley?
I'm a translator.
From what to what?
English and Spanish.
English and Spanish. Either way?
Both ways, yes.
Both ways.
Okay,
Terrific.
So what's your conundrum, Francisco?
Well, I used to live in a developing country before coming to the U.S., and back there I used to work with U.S. companies by offering them rates that even lower than those in the U.S. would allow me to make more for my work than I could earn there. Now that I'm on the other side of the globalization coin, I'm a bit confused. I see a lot of work going to translators overseas who used to do the same thing I used to do. I feel I shouldn't do anything to undercut their efforts. On the other hand, I cannot compete with the rates they offer. My conundrum is, should I pursue my own self-interest regardless of where I am, or should I strive for a compromise that's logically and ethically acceptable to me?
If the way you described it, there's a market for translators, the global price is a certain way, either you can afford to sell your labor at that price or you can't. If you can't, you're out of business. What's operating here other than the cold logic of supply and demand?
Unfortunately, I think that the main driving consideration for giving work to a translator is cost rather than quality. You know, that causes work to go where it costs less.
Well, it sounds like you've got a practical problem and a philosophical problem. The practical problem is how to add value to what you do for your customers here so that you'll get your share of the business, even though you have to charge more in order to live in Berkeley. Then the philosophical question is how do you feel about these things when you've been on both sides of the fence? It seems to me that you're in a unique position to appreciate the position of the people that are competing with Americans for jobs, and you're just going to have to cut out a role that makes the extra amount you have to charge here worthwhile.
I wonder, there's a generalized worry here. I mean, should we feel sad when globalization undermines intact ways of life that we're involved in? Or should we say, you know, that's progress?
I think it's reasonable to feel saddened. I mean, it's globalization, Walmartization. In the bigger picture, good doesn't mean you have to deny that in the smaller picture, it's a real loss.
But if you were talking to that guy in the developing country and he was telling you how wonderful it is that he now has access to these markets and you could see that he was no longer living in a shack and he had a better life, would you say, shucks, too bad, you've got a better life and I've got to change?
No, I wouldn't. But if I were to see the guys in the developing countries not benefiting from globalization, but just being made miserable in new ways by international companies instead of local companies, I might not feel so sanguine about it. So, Francisco, here's my suggestion. You got to develop a story you can tell about how your translation service is better than anything they could get overseas. Use advertising, use imagination, use color printers, whatever. Then actually subcontract out all the translating to to your old friends in Central and South America and pay them a little bit more than they get paid otherwise, so you feel pretty good about that. Make up for volume, convert it into a big company. You make a lot of money, and you won't even have to conjugate Spanish verbs anymore.
What do you think of that, Francisco?
That sounds pretty good, actually. The Walmart of translation.
That's brilliant.
Well, the brilliant part will be figuring out exactly what Francisco can use to convince people why they should come to you rather than somebody else.
Right.
Francisco, I don't think we've solved your conundrum. It's a hard and enduring thing, and lots of people are going to face it as more and more globalization happens. And I don't know, but I hope we've given you at least some diversion and help you think about it a little bit.
You have indeed, and thank you a lot. You have clarified the panorama for me.
So I think it should be Berkeley, the home of free speech, now gives you quality translation.
There you go.
There you go.
Okay. Bye, Francisco.
Well, goodbye, Francisco.
Thanks a lot, guys.
If you have a philosophical problem or quandary that's affecting your work or your play or keeping you awake at night, John and I would be happy to lend an ear and maybe give you some sound advice.
Go to the Philosophy Talk website and poke the conundrums button with your mouse, or just send an email to conundrums@philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Rujin Shin, Neil Van Leeuwen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley, and to our senior consulting producer, Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW, local public radio, San Francisco, where our program originated.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.com. .org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.